Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. The Kincaid Fire in Northern California is now 86% contained. According to CAL FIRE, the fire has burned over 77,000 acres and destroyed 352 structures, including 167 homes. As of yesterday, more than 6,000 people were still under mandatory evacuation. The fire in Southern California, which is about 65 miles northwest of downtown Los Angeles, threatens 1,800 homes and millions of dollars worth of fruits. Joining us with an update is Joseph Serna, a wildfire reporter with the LA Times. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So we have good news in Northern California. Unfortunately, not so good news in Southern California. There was another raging fire overnight. Can you give us the latest? What is happening in Southern California?
Yeah, with the Maria fire, as you'd mentioned, there's 1,800 homes that are threatened and about 7,500 residents that are evacuated. The fire is about 8,700 acres and no percent contained. Right now it's being driven by the wind. It's in Santa Paula. It's in what we would call a canyon that's kind of created its own wind tunnel, so it's blasting the fire west toward the ocean and toward more homes. But we're hoping that the winds are going to die either late this evening or by tomorrow.
And how many people have been evacuated? How many people have been displaced?
Thousands. Right now we have about 7,500 in all of those homes. But it could grow, if the fire makes a push closer to more homes.
You know, we have been covering the fires regularly up here, and fire officials have learned so much from past fires. And a lot of community activists on the ground say things are much more efficient. They are also providing information in Spanish for immigrants and Spanish speakers. What is it like in Southern California? Are the same things happening just in terms of things being more efficient in terms of giving out information?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lesson that I think a lot of folks across California have learned the hard way over these last few fires, these last few years, where either evacuations weren't as efficient as they should have been, or ahead of the fire arriving, the notifications to get out or giving people real-time information about the fire as it's approaching, that hasn't always been the best. There's been technological failures, management failures, but it seems like especially this year, as you can see by the stretch of these evacuations, some of these go, you know, up to 40 miles away from the fire front. Everyone's being extra cautious this year and putting out information. They're kind of throwing everything at it and giving every information piece of information they can to the public. So they're definitely doing a better effort this year, just really across the state, to keep everybody informed and get them out far ahead of time. That comes with its own complaints, but it's definitely more information than what's been provided in years past.
And how are prepared our local authorities to reach out to vulnerable populations and people who might not be getting the information? Your colleague, Brittany Mejia, has been getting a lot of attention for the piece she wrote about the gardeners and the house cleaners showing up to clean homes in very wealthy areas.
Yeah, that's been a challenge, and that's a challenge that I think is going to persist. It is the way we have it set up in Southern California. You know, people have to sign up for these alerts through the county or the city, and then they can get information through a text message and things like that. But if you don't live in that area, if you haven't signed up for it, there's no guarantee you're going to get it. And what Brittany had found, especially with some of these West Side communities, is that homeowners weren't communicating with the people they were employing. And those folks essentially had no way of knowing unless they had signed up for themselves on one of these alert programs for the, you know, the area where they're working as opposed to where they're living. There really wasn't a direct way for them to do it unless they happened to, you know, catch the news at the exact right time and, you know, proactively decide not to stay. But they weren't getting any information from their employers or really from city officials directly.
Joseph, I wonder what you think about how the media all across the board cover this. I have to say, I've been impressed with some of the national news. The New York Times had an amazing photo essay of people who were evacuated, who were living in their RVs in Walmart parking lot in Roanoke Park. And then we had excellent reporting from another colleague of yours at the LA Times about Lake County. And this is a fairly poor community. They live paycheck to paycheck. They were living in freezing conditions, and they're going to have a hard time paying their rent today. It's November 1st. So there's been a lot of good reporting about vulnerable communities in this state. And it's sad that this is what it takes because, of course, you often hear that there's so much money here, which there is. It's the fifth largest economy in the world. But there's so many people struggling in this state.
Well, they're all over the place. I mean, I covered the Valley Fire in Lake County in 2015. And that county in particular, just the last 5 years, they've been hit over and over and over with devastating fires, losing hundreds of homes sometimes. That county in particular has been hard hit, and they are vulnerable. They're not economically vibrant like some other parts of the state. In terms of the coverage, we're actually having a slower fire year than we have in almost a decade, and the destruction has been a fraction of what it is. But the amount of coverage we've gotten, I think, has been positive because it's touching on the things you've mentioned and that we've covered at the Times, which is how these things are affecting vulnerable communities, how these power outages at the grid that these utilities are doing, how they're not allowing folks to, have situational awareness. They might not get evacuations. The focus is shifting to the things that, like you've mentioned, are really affecting the vulnerable populations, folks who can't afford to have generators, who don't have maybe cell phones, computers, TVs even. That's great that's where the focus is turning, because that's really where we're going to be able to save lives, is when we can get infrastructure in place, information in place, where everybody can be on the same page and know what's happening.
Right. And NBC News had a great piece yesterday. Latino farm workers face serious health risks due to California's wildfires. And it starts with the community activists saying, what is happening here? And then journalists go in there to write the story. Before we let you go, Joseph, what are your thoughts about the winds? Because we saw hurricane winds up here last week, and now you're seeing winds upward of 70 miles an hour.
Yeah, I mean, as a wildfire reporter, and I've covered fires here for a number of years, every time I see a red flag warning or a red flag conditions or even just generally high winds, it makes me a little bit nervous because, fires are solved or are squashed very quickly most of the time. 95% of our fires are extinguished rapidly, but the ones that do the most damage, that take the most lives, are the wind-driven ones. And down here, we've gone on almost 67 hours of red flag conditions and strong winds and dry air, and it makes us nervous because that's a challenge. It defeats wildfire firefighter defenses and all that. So it's not pleasant. It keeps us all on edge, but we're here and ready to cover it.
And what are you working on right now?
Right now, personally, I am working with some colleagues. We're looking more at the grid and all the major utilities and how they handle fires and how prepared their infrastructure is for that, as well as mutual aid. As we reported last week, during the Woolsey Fire last year, there were some challenges with mutual aid in California because resources were stretched so thin. So we're doing a little bit more reporting on that to see how California's mutual aid system stands up in this kind of new era of fire.
Well, Joseph, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
You too. Joseph Serna is a wildfire reporter with the LA Times. And if you don't check the LA Times regularly, you really should. They've been doing excellent reporting on these fires, especially looking at how vulnerable communities have been affected. And you can find reporting at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. Now we are going to Baghdad. We're going to talk about the mass uprising in Iraq. Since October 25th, over 250 people have been killed. A number of young people, activists, and journalists have been arrested, and the crackdown has been brutal. Joining us now is Nabil Salah, an independent journalist based in Baghdad. He has been reporting from Tahrir Square in Baghdad. Hi, Nabil. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, my pleasure.
So, Nabil, a general question before we dive in and talk about the protests. Can you talk about what really sparked all of this? What is day-to-day life like for average Iraqis right now?
No, Iraqis go through hell every day, like for over 16 days since the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq and handed the country to these savages that has been ruling Iraq since then. The locals have been marginalized and living and drowning in misery, and they wake up to polluted air, to concrete blocks. They go out to work and they have to go through congested streets. Then they return home to pay large sums of money to private generators, because despite spending so much money, the Ministry of Electricity hasn't improved the power supply yet. And of course, water shortages. But it's not that just sparked the uprising. I want to name it an uprising, because the average people have been living through humiliation for over 16 years. They are humiliated. They have been facing injustice. Almost every corner of the country is broken. The infrastructure, the government even has failed to provide a public toilet in the capital, Baghdad, since 2003. Imagine.
Wow. You know, Nabil, I want to ask you, the U.S. invasion of Iraq is covered here from a very political perspective, or if there's a car bombing, we get a headline that's buried on page 15, for example. We can do an entire show about the invasion and the effect that it has had. But how would you summarize the effect that this U.S. invasion has had on Iraq?
Okay, I will tell you a little story, like what I have been through after the invasion. Well, while my peers were maybe watching Disney movies elsewhere in the world, I had to watch charred tanks on the streets of Baghdad and in 2003 and hear the bombing. And actually, the U.S. brutality has impacted us. Like earlier in 1998, my father used to take me up on the roof, and I used to see the fighter jets of America bombing Baghdad. And then the war in 2003, I saw everything. And then my father was kidnapped between 2005 and 2008. My father was kidnapped. My uncle was kidnapped. My other uncle was kidnapped. And we were displaced from our home. My brother had to leave because we were from a Sunni neighborhood, and he wouldn't be able to move around the city freely. He might be killed by militias. So he has to leave to Syria alongside millions of Iraqis who perished in the open seas trying to reach a country that respects human rights. But unfortunately, recently, all the countries has been, like the European Union, even the UN, they have been supporting the government, thinking there's a stability in Iraq, finally, but there is no stability, actually. Since January until now, I have been following the daily news. There are suicide attempts every day in impoverished cities in the south. There are attacks by remnant IS militants in Diyala and Salah ad-Din, and people are getting killed. Even security personnel are getting killed. So yeah, this is all the impact and consequences of the invasion.
The relatives that you mentioned, Nabil, who were kidnapped, who kidnapped them, and are they back now with your family?
Yeah, they are back. My uncle was kidnapped by Al-Qaeda, my father by Jaish al-Mahdi, and my other uncle by just a gang. They stole his car, hijacked his car, and chased him, but he survived.
Wow. Now, Bill, you have been reporting from Tahrir Square every night, and your Twitter feed is full of stories and photos of people who are protesting, people who have been killed. Can you just talk mm-hmm. about what is it like in Tahrir Square? What are you hearing from people?
Well, like, no matter how much I write, no matter how many pictures I take, I wouldn't be able to depict what's really happening. It's big. It's unprecedented. You have people chanting loudly against every political party, every politician, every cleric, and rejecting Iran's influence. Young people partying around. But beyond the party, of course, there are people dying on the bridges on El Sinek and Jumhuriya Bridge. Just now, 4 minutes ago, the Iraqi Revolution account on Twitter says security forces minutes ago targeted a medical tent with tear gas grenade in Tahrir Square. I left 2 hours ago, and this just happened. Mm. And an earlier tweet from the same account, the Iraqi Revolution, said a female protester received a tear gas grenade into her head. She died. Actually, this brings me to talk about the Iraqi High Commission for Human Rights. Let me see. Dr. Ali Al-Bayati, member of this commission, said 6 died, 300 wounded, mostly suffocation today, only in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Says medical, one of the medical tents, there are over 10 medical tents on Tahrir, said they daily receive between 5 to 20 skin burns cases, which is like normal tear gas doesn't make that. And also paralyzation cases. So they said this is worrying, and they called for an investigation. And this brings me also to a report by Amnesty earlier. I read earlier today, saying that these tear gas grenades are actually manufactured, maybe in I think Hungary and Serbia, if I'm not mistaken. And they were actually meant for military purposes, but of course they are using on the people because no one is holding anyone accountable.
According to that report from Amnesty International, they say all the evidence points to Iraqi security forces deploying these military-grade grenades against protesters, apparently aiming for their heads or bodies at point-blank range. Lynn Malouf, yep, Middle East Research Director at Amnesty, said the lack of accountability for unlawful killings and injuries by security forces is sending the message that they can kill and maim with impunity. How do you explain mm-hmm. this level of violence against these peaceful protesters?
No, this avoiding punishment is a culture that is entrenched in the post-invasion Iraq. You see, employees at any ministry, they are delinquent. They don't do their job right. And you see, for example, a soldier insulting an officer on a checkpoint in front of people in the morning because he has connections to militias, and the officer doesn't, and the officer has to just keep quiet and listens. And pretends that he is not hearing. And the government has failed to provide numbers of casualties, like accurate numbers of casualties in Mosul and before. I mean, after 2003. So, on a practice in today's Iraq, they have been killing people since October 1, standing on the bridge, and the same guys and these inane political rhetoric are proving nothing but just rhetoric. You know, they are the killing is continuing.
Nabil, do we still have you?
Okay.
Great. We're talking with Nabil Salah. He's an independent journalist based in Baghdad. He has been reporting from Tahrir Square, reporting on these unprecedented protests that are happening in Baghdad. Nabil, let's talk a little bit more about who's on the streets. There's such a wide range of people, all ages. Can you talk more about who you're seeing on the streets?
Mm-hmm. Iraqis from all walks of life. You see the rich and the poor rushing to Al-Jumhuriyah Bridge to evacuate slain protesters. You see them sharing food. People coming from Kalamiyah, from Al-Ghazaliyah, from Sadr City, from Adamiyah, Sunnis, Shias, Christians, everyone. It's like they. I keep hearing on that the government did like the best thing the post-invasion political system done to the people is unifying them by oppression.
And what are you hearing from the protesters who are now risking their lives by being on these streets day after day?
Yeah, they keep on killing them and they keep on coming back. They say they will keep on doing this until they overthrow the regime. I told them, what if the prime minister resigns, the president? They say that wouldn't change anything. We need to overthrow the entire political system. We need a homeland. That is the main slogan.
And so their demands are get rid of the entire regime.
Yeah, and the entire political system. The parties, political parties, and their armed wings.
Tell what do we need to know about the government right now? Who is in power in Iraq?
Who is in power in Iraq? That is a question. I don't think Iraqis are in power of Iraq. Like, if you ask any normal, ordinary citizen on the street, he'll tell you Iran or America. They are the two puppeteers having the last say on many of Iraq's political decisions. Just now, I read a statement on a local media, said the Iraqi Minister of Electricity met his Iranian counterpart and made a deal on increasing cooperation in the power sector. That just says how about the sway about Iran on Iraq's political and economic situation.
And so, Iran, the U.S., any other regional powers?
No, mainly Iran, of course, mainly.
Today we're speaking with Nabil Saleh, an independent journalist based in Baghdad. He has been reporting from Tahrir Square night by night. How are we getting numbers, Nabil, numbers of the people who have been killed and people who've been injured? Where are you getting that information?
Well, the Iraqi High Commission for Human Rights, that's my source. But I've also been interviewing field medics on Tahrir and other doctors from Iraqi hospitals who privately said that the actual numbers are way higher than what is announced by the government.
And what are you hearing from the medics? Do they have what they need to treat people who've been injured?
Yes, Iraqis are incredibly generous, from food to medical equipment to even masgouf and bonfires and chai. Everything they have, everything they need is at their disposal on Tahrir. They have all the medical equipment, like most of them are donated from pharmacists and doctors, yes.
How hopeful are people that these sustained protests can really take on this entrenched political system?
It's an arduous mission. It's not easy. And they know that they are not. It's not easy. But I will say this, it's becoming personal to each and every individual on Tahrir and all the other squares that are witnessing rallies in Iraq. It's becoming personal. Why? Because everyone has lost a friend, a brother, a mother, a sister. Everyone has been going through humiliation, and now it's a wake-up call to everyone, and they are not letting this opportunity slip off their fingers. That's what I sense from my presence at the square every day.
Wow. Today we are speaking with Nabil Saleh, an independent journalist who is based in Baghdad. He has written for a number of publications, including The New Arab and Jadalia. Nabil has been reporting from Tahrir Square in Baghdad on a regular basis and has been uploading photos and basically just what he's seen on the streets on his Twitter account. And you can find links to his work at yourcallradio.org. These protests have been taking place since October 25th. And according to reports, how many people have died according to the reports that you have seen, Nabil?
Today? Six only in Baghdad.
Six, but since October 25th.
Over 100, wow. At least 100, according to the Iraqi High Commission for Human Rights.
And how many?
And over.
How many people have been injured?
Thousands.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And if you have any questions for Nabil about what is happening on the ground in Iraq, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are talking about the unprecedented mass uprising in Iraq with Nabil Saleh, an independent journalist who has been reporting from Tahrir Square in Baghdad. I wanted to ask you, Nabil, you were talking about the United States and just what this invasion, the U.S. invasion, has done to Iraq and the Iraqi people. What is the presence of the Americans in Iraq today? Are they still occupying the Green Zone?
No, they are not, but they have many military bases in Western Iraq and in Central Iraq and in Northern Iraq, mainly providing training and expertise to the sons of the father they killed over 16 years ago. I mean, the Iraqi military. Yes.
And do you see any American presence on a regular basis in Iraq?
No, I don't. On the streets, no. Only like when they withdrew from Syria, we've seen the footage on social media from them in Erbil, I think.
What about oil wealth? Iraq has vast oil wealth, but many Iraqis have little access to basic necessities, as you've said.
Yeah. So yeah, this is actually heartbreaking to many. In Basra, for example, people are suffocated and they are getting cancers from the poisons they breathe in from the oil exploration operations by foreign companies that are, of course, benefiting, as well as the Iraqi politicians do. And I'm not sure, but over six billion US dollars of exports and revenues they get from oil exports a month, Iraqis, if I'm not mistaken. And Iraqis haven't seen any of that. They still press a button to light their rooms, and it doesn't light up. They live in the darkness.
So where is all this money going?
Of course, to the pockets of the parties and politicians, and of course the companies get a share.
According to reports, Iraq hit record production in August with an output of almost 5 million barrels a day. It is OPEC's second largest oil producer. So we're talking about a lot of money here.
Yeah, lots of money that people aren't seeing a dime of it. You see people, young people, eke out a living by pulling or pushing handcarts through the ramshackle alleyways in Baghdad and begging on every intersection like flocks of homeless widows and children on the streets. This is very contradictive to the numbers you just mentioned. So this is a reality. Yes, sorry.
Iraq has grown to almost 40 million people, and according to the World Bank, 3/5 of the population live on less than $6 a day.
Yes, and apparently they'll keep on living this way unless something big changes. That's why you see young people sacrificing their lives for a future that they have never dreamt of being possible, but now they are with their own hands, they are making it come true, and hopefully we'll see a big change for the better.
And when we're talking about young people, Nabil, and I'm not sure how old you are, but you sound pretty young. These are young people who were children when the United States invaded.
No, actually, they haven't born yet. I'm 27, by the way.
Okay.
Let me tell you something. There's a guy I interviewed yesterday. He's a kid, actually. He's 12 years old. He's a tuk-tuk driver, wearing a helmet. He's chubby and adorable. He showed me a tear gas. They told me they shattered my windshield. I told him, where are you going? He told me, I'm going to the bridge to evacuate more injured people. You see these guts of steel. They are very daring, you know. They are facing death, and they are peaceful. And they are not giving up. The more they hit them, they keep coming back. I see wounded people walking back to their same spot, unshaken by the loud bangs of stun grenades. And like they are fascinating.
Hmm. Wow. 12.
And some of them even come from families that are from middle class families. They have works. Their families have works. They are good grades in school, and one of them I interviewed was probably going to a medical school, but he came here. He cleans a bridge and delivers medical equipment to people, and he told me, I want to die for my country. They are fascinating.
Wow. What has it been like for you, Nabil, just reporting on this, watching this, seeing your fellow citizens put their lives on the line?
Yeah, it's I'm overwhelmed because I participated in 2015 before Muqtada Sadr hijacked the movement, and it's also heartbreaking to see people suffer. But it's I get goosebumps. It's inspiring. I'm humbled by their acts, by their braveness. And for example, I was like in the days before, maybe on Friday 25th, if I'm not mistaken, and I was hit by tear gas alongside three colleagues, and they came to the rescue. They carried one photographer to an ambulance, and I fell to the ground unconscious, and they came and sprayed Pepsi on my eyes, and they handed me my camera, and they rescued my life.
Wow. Nabil, we have an email from Lee who says, what support do Iraqis get from Iraqi Americans? Is there a strong relationship?
Yeah, of course. I see from a friend, an Iraqi friend who lives in Canada. He says, like, dozens of thousands of dollars have been donated to Iraqis. Like, there has been a fundraiser. And also, people have been sharing the atrocities on social media. Yeah. So this unified everyone, the local, the ones in Iraq and the expatriates.
Nabil, before we let you go, when we're talking about 12-year-olds on the street, older people on the streets, and then the brutal crackdown by the government, who are these people? I mean, are they in full-on military-style gear, or can you explain that to us? Because we're watching these uprisings around the world right now, and the crackdowns from Hong Kong to Chile to Iraq have been brutal. So who's carrying out this brutality?
Well, let me tell you this. I interviewed the protesters today. They told me these guys on the bridges are not Iraqi. They grow beard, and Iraqi military personnel are not allowed to. They have to shave, of course. They told me they are camouflaged. They have their faces. And this is, of course, even if you are in the military, you don't have to cover your face. So, yeah, there is lots of speculations about who these guys are. Are they militias? Are they, they are unidentified, but riot police are there, and of course, yeah.
Is there
it's
any
just confusing?
Any idea who are they, where they're coming from? I mean, I guess it's difficult to know.
Some protesters claim they are come from Iran.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Where does this go from here, Nabil? What are your thoughts about what's next?
What's next? You can just expect those people who lost so much in recent days and for the entirety of their lives to just sit back and let it go. Even if they quash the movement, maybe tomorrow, if not tomorrow, next month, next year, something bigger will happen.
Mm.
People are now realizing that they have been, like everyone, this has been an eye-opener to the humiliation we have been going through. And this is just the beginning.
You know, since you brought up Iran, we found an article in the Washington Post, and it is called Protests in Iraq and Lebanon Pose a Challenge to Iran. And it starts by, the day after anti-government protests erupted in Iraq, Iranian General Qasem Soleimani flew to Baghdad late at night and took a helicopter to the heavily fortified Green Zone, where he surprised a group of top security officials by chairing a meeting in place of the prime minister. The head of Iran's elite Quds force and the architect of its regional apparatus signaled Tehran's concerns over the protests. He said, quote, "We in Iran know how to deal with protests. This happened in Iran and we got it under control."
Yeah, this tells a lot. I read similar thing on Twitter, on Reuters, and about Soleimani's visits. And I don't rule that out. They have been controlling lots. They have a large sway on Iraq's political. They have a lot political scene, of course. And they have militias. They are back in here, and I wouldn't rule that out. And but it tells you how far Iran can reach in its interference in Iraq's affairs.
Wow. Well, Nabil, thank you so much for your reporting. Thank you for joining us. Please stay safe, and we would love to check in with you in the coming weeks.
I'll try, but it's not a safe country. Thank you.
I'm so sorry. Thank you. Thank you so much, Nabil. Nabil Saleh is an independent journalist based in Baghdad. He has been reporting from Tahrir Square. He's written for a number of publications, including The New Arab and Jadalia. And follow Nabil on Twitter because he has been reporting and posting photos of people who've been killed. His Twitter handle is at Nabil, NabilAimFrachi. And we will link to his Twitter account at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Mike Elk, the founder of the Payday Report, to talk about the deal reached between General Motors and the United Auto Workers. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of the GM strike and the deal reached between General Motors and the United Auto Workers. We're joined by Mike Elk, the founder of Payday Report. This is an independent grassroots site that focuses on labor and workers. Mike also covers labor and immigration issues for The Guardian. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Great to be on the show, Rose.
It's great to have you back. And Mike, before we dive in and talk about this contract, can you remind us, why did almost 46,000 GM workers go on strike in the first place?
Well, they went on a 40-day strike, and the big issues were outsourcing. Obviously, that was the biggest issue, which is that GM used to have in the contracts that they wouldn't close a plant during the life of a contract, and there'd be certain written commitments. GM, in this contract, has stripped all that language out. And the strikers were supposed to strike to reopen those plants, but they only got a few of those plants approved. The other big issue was temp wages and giving temps a permanent path to employment. Now, what General Motors agreed to in this contract was that they would hire temps to be full-time after working for 2 years, but they had to have more than 30 days of continuous service. So GM could easily lay someone off, and there's no protections against that in order to break up the continuous service time. The third big issue was eliminating the two-tier wage system. Obviously, they haven't fully eliminated it yet. They cut down the time for some employees to move to the top, but there's still other employees that work in warehouses and auto parts suppliers that are making, you know, wages as a result that are lower than their coworkers as a result of the bailout terms. So the UAW came up largely short, and it showed in how narrowly this passed. This contract only was approved with 57% of the support of the membership, which is very, very low compared to most contracts. You know, you look at contracts like the Chicago Teachers Union or the LA Times, those contracts are approved by 80, 90% margins. To have something approved by 57% shows you how upset people are. And, you know, the only reason it was approved by that much is because the UAW went around and they whipped votes, and a lot of local labor leaders, thinking that it would pass, voted for it for that reason.
Mike, you were on the ground at many strike areas. What did you hear from workers during this strike? What really stood out for you?
I think what stood out for me was the courage to keep pushing on. And I think really the big issue was always keeping GM production in the U.S. So many people have seen those jobs eliminated. And I think what really struck me was how many people I met that were multi-generational GM employees. Their parents had worked there, their grandparents had worked there, and that they were there standing up for trying to keep the jobs there. This contract doesn't do it. It merely puts, it doesn't stop the bleeding.
Well, so here's the vote. 23,389 workers voted yes, and 17,501 voted no. So that is a major division. Talking to workers, what really divided them about this new contract?
Well, I think the issue that divided them is that some of these workers work in plants where, you know, the company's invested a lot of money recently, and the likelihood of them closing is very low. Those plants voted for it, versus the plants that feared they might close voted against it.
And what was the reasoning?
Well, the reasoning being that it used to be in the contract that they would put, you know, certain allocations that they would allocate. We're going to build this product here. We're going to invest X amount of dollar. And this contract contains none of that. The New York Times called it a big victory for General Motors.
Hmm. So what is in the contract?
Well, I mean, there's nothing that I think is too exciting in the contract. I mean, there's, you know, there was a big ratification bonus. The way they got this passed was they put an $11,000 bonus if workers voted for it. So you put folks out on strike for 6 weeks, and you all of a sudden offer them $11,000. That looks pretty good to a lot of folks.
Mm. Well, yeah, and it also just speaks to, you know, people are really struggling to make ends meet. And it just speaks to how difficult things are for workers who used to, if you look at inflation, I mean, they used to make a lot more money a couple of decades ago.
Yeah.
Right? And the other thing I wanted to ask you, Mike, you know, when we had you on, we talked about GM CEO Mary Barra's compensation, almost $22 million, which is 281 times the median GM worker. She is one of the 20 highest paid CEOs in the United States. A lot of workers were talking about that during the strike. I think it's really important to point out this incredibly high CEO pay that was not this high in the 70s and the 80s. What are you hearing from workers about this?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of workers are obviously very upset and frustrated by that. You know, it really upsets workers, you know, to not see major raises and see, you know, CEO taking home that kind of pay.
Right. And Mike, it sounds like you're pretty tired from doing all this reporting.
I'm just sick. I'm still in bed.
Oh, you're in. Okay, I'm sorry. Wow, thank you. Well, thank you for joining us. We're going to let you go in about 5 minutes.
Okay. No, sorry.
All right. No, it's all right. I mean, you've been on the ground, you know, giving a shout out to your organization. You guys work on a shoestring budget, and your entire goal of Payday Report is to really give workers a voice.
We did 28 articles and 30 videos from 5 different states. You know, we traveled more than anybody else, and we did that because our readers gave us donations. Our readers want to see this type of news, but this news isn't in the media, you know, at all. And so, you know, it's really up to readers to come and fund this kind of reporting because no one else is doing it.
What do you think of the way the national media reported on this? They were slow in the beginning, and then things picked up.
Well, they were slow, things picked up, and then they ignored it. But, you know, it was tough to cover because, in part, the UAW wasn't really giving updates on what was happening. I mean, the Chicago Teachers Union just went on strike. The Chicago Teachers Union would every day list these long bullet points of what the company proposed and what they countered. UAW would just say, we're making progress, and then General Motors would go to the press and leak what was happening. And they would paint an overly rosy picture of it.
What is the relationship like between the United Auto Workers Union and the workers?
It's major. The relationship between the United Auto Workers.
Yes, I mean that. Like, for example,
top. They used to be very close, but they're not nearly as close right now.
You know, the top brass, for example, at the UAW. What kind of communication goes on between them and the workers?
And not much at all. I mean, the UAW has traditionally been a very top-down union. And, you know, a lot of local union presidents had no idea what was being negotiated at the table. So everybody read what was in the press and thought it was a much brighter picture than they thought it was, but it winded up not being that way.
Yeah, in fact, one of the workers who voted against the deal told you, quote, as far as I'm concerned, anybody that votes yes for this contract is selling out the American people.
I heard a lot of workers say that. I mean, this was at a plant in Rochester, New York, that might close. And these workers voted against it 5-1. So, I mean, as you can tell, you had some plants that they were getting work out of the deal. They voted for it overwhelmingly. So the company really divided and conquered the union. Mm. And part of it was that the union leadership never really communicated much with its own membership.
Mm. What do the workers who voted against it plan to do from here?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk of forming a UAW reform caucus. I've seen a lot of stuff like that. I mean, the UAW is one of the most top-down unions in the country. 6 of their top officials just got convicted of bribery or embezzlement, and they have indicated that the president was involved in some of these schemes.
So it's very likely there could be a shakeup of the UAW leadership, and a lot of rank-and-file members are going to be pushing for it. Hmm. I mean, it's fascinating watching this stuff in the age of social media, because you can go into these groups and you can see what they're talking about.
Wow. What about General Motors, Mike? What are they gaining from this deal? As you said, divide and conquer.
They're getting the freedom to close plants whenever they want. They've never had that before.
They get to what?
The freedom to close plants. They never had that before.
Hmm. And what are you hearing? Do you think that that'll happen in the near term?
Yeah, I think they will. I think you'll see more plant closures.
Hmm. Today we're speaking with Mike Elk about the contract between auto workers and the UAW. UAW members voted in favor of this contract, 23,389, and then 17,501 voted against it. Mike, before we let you go, what role are unions going to play in this upcoming election, and what are you hearing from workers about the election?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the working class voters, I mean, they're breaking for Bernie. A lot of people like Bernie. A lot of people like his ideas. I don't think there's as much enthusiasm for other candidates in the race as there is for Bernie. I mean, there is some for Biden, but I think that's slowly fading as his health issues become apparent.
Hmm. Well, and just the fact that unions have lost so much power over the last decades, and they used to just be a force when it comes to organizing and getting people out to the polls. Do you think that, I mean, what are your thoughts about what kind of organizing will happen this time around?
Well, I mean, I think you'll see the same stuff as always, you know, the type of door-to-door work. And, you know, you might see more unions getting involved in progressive challenges. It's not clear yet.
Hmm. And what about, can you just give us an update? You've also been focused on the Chicago teachers' strike. And they
I wrote one story on that. I haven't been covering it too much.
Well, you wrote one story. It was 200,000 members strong, and they just announced a deal. Have you been following that?
I don't know the contents of the deal. I wrote one story on one aspect of it. But it looks like it's going to end and pass overwhelmingly.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So, Mike, just in our final minutes, for the next year, this year we saw so much activity on the streets, from teachers to home care workers, fast food workers, auto workers. I mean, so many workers are organizing. A lot of journalists. You've been tweeting about various media organizations that are voting to unionize, and a lot of their employers are really pushing back on them. What are your thoughts about what we can expect from 2020 when it comes to organizing?
I think you're going to see more strikes. I think there's a new sense of confidence among a lot of workers right now. You know, and I think that's just building. You saw the teacher strikes, you saw the auto worker strikes, and these were big events. And so I think you're going to see more workers doing things like this.
Right, and they also show that they're very successful in some cases.
Yep.
Also, the culinary workers in Las Vegas have been getting a lot of attention because they have been so incredibly successful with their campaign.
Yeah, they've been getting a lot of attention. I'm not as familiar with that.
Yeah. And then in terms of the political candidates, Mike, we know Bernie is, I mean, he's out there. Elizabeth Warren actually went to Chicago to strike with the teachers. What are your thoughts about the Democrats overall when it comes to unions and striking and where they stand on these issues?
Well, look, I think a lot of the Democrats are going out on picket lines. I think Warren's going to have a very hard time getting support among organized labor. I mean, look, she worked for LTV. When they went into bankruptcy, and she helped kick miners out of their pensions. That's an issue that's going to play really bad in Western PA. You nominate Elizabeth Warren, there's no way you win Western PA where I'm at. LTV was a huge employer. She represented them in court, whereas Bernie has been really involved in some strikes out here in Western PA. So I think it's going to be interesting, and I think there's definitely going to be a duel, and I think some of it is that Bernie is known to be so active in unions, so it's going to force the other candidates to get even more involved.
And for people who haven't followed this LTV, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, there was an article in the New York Times that Camp brought up, is that Elizabeth Warren in the 1990s worked as an outside consultant to law firms in major cases, making $600 an hour, and she worked for companies that went bankrupt. She worked for a major employer here in Pittsburgh called LTV. It used to employ about 50,000 people in Pittsburgh, and she helped fight to strip workers of their pensions. You know, she claims since then that she's undergone a political conversion, but I don't see that playing at all here in Western PA. And if you don't win Western PA, you can't beat Trump. And
wow.
I just don't think she's going to play in union. I think her past work really hurts her.
Right. Well, and, you know, Mike, so many people are talking about the Obama union voter who voted for Trump and where that voter is, where that voter is going to be this time around.
Well, look, I have cousins who voted for Trump that are union members, and a lot of them would vote for Bernie. I think, you know, there's a distrust of certain types of politicians. But the thing about Bernie is he's always been consistent. Whereas I think with Warren, you know, you go look at, oh, you're making $600 an hour stripping coal miners in western Pennsylvania of their pensions. It doesn't play well around here in Pittsburgh.
Right, right. Where you are in Pittsburgh, what about Joe Biden? What are you hearing from union workers there about him?
Some people like him, but I think increasingly, you know, what's happening from what I'm hearing is he doesn't look like he's ready to play ball.
Mm. Well, Mike, I know you're sick. Thank you so much for joining us,
thanks,
as always. Thank you. That is Mike Elk. He is the founder of Payday Report, and I hope you can spend some time on their website. It's a very grassroots website, and they focus specifically on labor and workers. Mike also covers labor and immigration issues for The Guardian. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find out more about Your Call, sign up for our podcast, listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any guest ideas or feedback for us, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's Media Roundtable.